Professor Mirandi from University of Tehran. And he said, one thing you have to understand with the Strait of Hormuz is that it is closed right now, but it's not like there's soldiers there defending the shores. It's not like they have this huge naval fleet. He said they are being controlled by missile launchers that are sometimes hundreds, if not 200 right. kilometers away.
Exactly
right. Right. So it's not, you know, I think I just want to clarify that for our audience, because it's not like, you know, Iran has fortified the Strait of Hormuz and you have this incredible, you know, military presence there. It's essentially, it remains open in the sense that there's not a lot of people there, but anybody that's trying to go through, they're going to fire a missile at them and take out that boat. I don't even see how you could do that. I mean, if you're going to try to, let's just say 1,000 men are going to come in on these helicopters, that's a long journey across the strait. I believe it's 24 miles to get across the straits, right? So, I mean, that's quite a long time in the air for these helicopters, and then you're going to try to land in a Karg island. I just have to imagine these guys would just get absolutely peppered with Iranian missiles and warfare. Would that not happen?
Right. Of course it would. That's exactly why I'm screaming that they should not try this, because it's possible that the invasion force could be mostly shot down before it even gets there. And you know, you're talking about helicopters going down in the middle of the strait. I mean, it's going to be hard for any of them to survive, much less to get somebody in to try to rescue them. And then once they get down on there, because probably some would get down, because almost surely what you would see, it's not just they would fly helicopters out there without cover. All these aircraft right now that have been peppering and firing targets all over Iran would definitely be vectored in all in here. And they would probably, this would be preceded by, an air campaign similar to what we did in Desert Storm, where they first of all went and hit all the surface targets that were in their area to soften it up, et cetera. Then you would get support, close air support from other A-10s, Apache helicopters, or something that would give cover to them. So there would be a lot of attempt to do that kind of thing. But as you point out correctly, the biggest risk is that a lot of it, the fire against those helicopters wouldn't come from shore batteries per se. That I'm sure some will, but it could come from dozens, scores, or even hundreds of miles away from other places that could come in and hit a lot of those targets. So it's just nearly an impossible military task to accomplish.
Now, let's imagine that the United States is successful and gets boots on the ground. Now, tell us about the logistics of that. You touched on that briefly. I'd like to expand as far as, you know, how does it work with meals and water and, you know, place to sleep, things like that? How does those daily life, I mean, you know, because you're in the middle of a desert, right? I mean, there's no infrastructure around. I mean, you basically have to, have your supplies with you. I mean, when they're deploying out there, are they carrying a certain amount of meals with them? And how does that, like the logistics, work?
So you will, this would be similar to how the Marines landed on some of the islands when in the island hopping campaign of World War II, where the U.S. Marines were moving, you know, closer towards eventually to Iwo Jima and some of the city. Guadalcanal, I think, is a real good example, because we inserted a lot of Marines on there. And so they had the ammunition and food and water, you know, supposed to last them for, I want to say it was 24 hours, 36 hours, something like that. But it was really hard to get the resupply in there. So there was a lot of the Marines that were starting to suffer from exhaustion and the lack of water. You know, they just couldn't go anymore because it was hard to get that through because of the enemy fire on there. So there was Japanese on the island, as there would be Iranians on the island as well. And then, of course, at that time, the artillery was the biggest that they had. Now we also have artillery and drones and missiles on top of all that we would have to worry about, that those Marines didn't. So it would be just withering fire here. And so the problem is that, you're going to come with whatever water you have, whether that's 82nd paratroopers or from the Marines, that once you use that up, if you can't get a clear line of resupply going in there, you could be held up from water as much as you could from enemy fire if you can't get it in there.
Yeah, that's just, and then of course, let's say that you're there, you know, you like you said, they might have enough food for 24, let's call it 48 hours. How do you restock them? How do you get them more water? How do you get them their supplies that they need? And then whatever operation they're going to try to carry out, how do you get them back out of there? Now you got to get loaded up in the same helicopters and attempt that same 24 mile journey across the strait, you know, assuming that we have the military jets to back those guys up. I mean, it just seems like a almost logistical nightmare. And I'm glad that you brought it up, the past where you were at, you know, just showing us that you trained from, was it August till February. You know, I mean, we're talking about a 6-month period there in order for you to mobilize. Now, obviously, a lot more troops. I mean, you're talking 500,000 troops with everybody there. So that's a very large force. It just doesn't seem logistically possible. To me, it doesn't seem like it's possible at all.
Right, and because you have to have both air support, air transport, you know, C-17s, C-130s, C-5s. You also have to have a lot of these ro-ro ships, et cetera. I mean, it is an enormous logistical air and sea lift capacity necessary to get an invasion force over there. And you have to have a force that's that big. When I did the Desert Storm there, we had an army of 750,000. Wow. Army is around, I think, 450, 475, something like that. Somewhere in between there, it fluctuates. But it's like 300,000 storm. And, of course, we have worldwide requirements. So they're literally, you know, to the four winds of the world. They would have to be reassembled somewhere or else vectored in from their different locations onto it, which, of course, requires logistics. More ships, more planes, transport, et cetera, which right now we're all deployed to this one to move ammunition. But now then you're going to have to stop that because it's a zero-sum deal. If those transports are taken away from ferrying, you know, resupplies and whatnot for air defense missiles, air power missiles that we were having, other logistics for the air war and the naval war, now you have to vector them onto a ground, and then that means that you're going to run short of the other because we don't have enough to do everything. And, of course, if you did something like that, you were basically saying – all the other global requirements we have around the world will be sacrificed for this because now we won't have this power projection capability anywhere, and everything will be concisely put in this one area, putting at risk everything in Europe, everything in our hemisphere, and everything in Asia Pacific. So there are some real consequences to even making the attempt.
That's a good point. Danny, you know, given your, you know, tremendous military background and experience, you have a very intimate knowledge of this. You've seen it firsthand in these military operations that you were involved with before. But when you're looking at it now, we're looking at a 1 month of this conquest, and we're nowhere close to the end, despite what Trump wants to say, what he wants to claim. But what is the single biggest misconception that U.S. policymakers have about Iran's military capabilities right now?
The single biggest misconception, in my view, is that we believe that the Iranian people can be bombed into submission. That we think that if we assassinate enough leaders and if we blow up enough stuff on the surface, that they're going to capitulate. And that is a gross mischaracterization of how any people operate. And we have so much in just the last century. I mean, look at the Britain in the Battle of Britain, when the Nazis tried to succumb them by bombing London and just knocking out everything through the air and their attacks on the country, especially in London. All that did was make the British resolve firm up more to get rid of the Nazis. Then later on, you had the Japanese. We were trying firebombing their cities. We did the same for Germany. We're closing in on that. They never surrendered. Only the nuclear bomb caused the Japanese to surrender. But otherwise, they would have continued to pay that price no matter how many cities we leveled. The Germans, the same way, they never gave up, until finally the capital city was taken and you had the convergence of the Red Army and the Allied armies. They never gave up. So no matter how many things, like the famous Dusseldorf firebombings, they didn't give up because of that. You have the Gaza Strip, this tiny little piece of area here where Israel bombed everything for like 2 years solid, and they never gave up, and they were never even the Hamas was never defeated. Houthis were not defeated by Saudi Arabia, and then by Israel, and then by us in the Red Sea, and they're still to this day still a viable force. Hezbollah. Everybody was assassinated, the leader, Hassan Nasrallah, all the generals, all the people, you know, this pager bombs, et cetera, so much damage, and yet they remained viable, and now they're engaging again. Why does anybody think that if all of that operation, and you can add the Ukrainians into that, is all the fire they've taken from Russia, to this day they have still not given up, and they still resist, even though they're way on the bottom side of the power dynamic between those two. Why is Iran going to give up after 4 weeks? I mean, that was or a few days is what the hope was. It was irrational. I mean, it doesn't understand human relations, much less the specifically ones for Iran. And you can look at them from how they behaved in the Iran-Iraq war that we helped support with Iraq against Iran for 8 years, and they never gave up, even though they lost hundreds of thousands of men and had their cities bombed and their leaders executed. So we have graphic experience on the Iranian side itself, and we ignored all that. So I think that is the number one biggest strategic failure of this whole operation so far.
Yeah, that's actually a fascinating answer, because you just brought in a history of so many different wars, and I think you pointed out is, you know, not one of them did the attacking force ever get bombed into submission, right? Because it makes sense. You're going to stand your territory, right? If we're in a war, I'm not just going to give up. I mean, I got to fight for what I want. And I mean, we certainly see that from the Iranians. I do want to bring in Israel here, because I think that at the start of this war, you know, there's a lot of speculation that obviously the United States went to war on behalf of Israel. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of strain between the United States and Israeli relationship. You know, I think Donald Trump has at times been, it's been very difficult to kind of rein in Benjamin Netanyahu. Of course, we've seen that with the war in Gaza, where, you know, Trump has said, please, you know, I don't want you to do this. Netanyahu the next day goes, well, guess what? We went ahead and did it because we want to do it. You know, how are you looking at that relationship between the U.S. and Israel right now and how it affects this war?
Well, I mean, you don't have to look any further than the recent resignation of Joe Kent from the number two position of the Office of Director of National Intelligence. He specifically cited that reason is why he could no longer in good conscience do his job, because he said it was self-evident from the inside that the Israelis and many compliant American Western media put pressure on the Trump administration, the president himself, to do things that were self-evidently not in America's interest. And I can only concur with my external observations with what he had on the inside, is that there were no need whatsoever for America to engage in this. Nothing to gain at all. In fact, I think that the 2025 12-day war was a violation of American law, the U.S. Constitution, and international law, and shouldn't have happened, but it did. And we claimed that it resulted in the obliteration of many of the nuclear facilities, which meant that there's now virtually no chance, at least in the near term, that they could start a bomb program, which they never had, at least not since 2003. So the justification then was missing, because they weren't going to a nuclear weapon. But even so, you did that then. So that made even more reason why we should not do one now, because the only thing that even we ostensibly cared about was them not developing a nuclear weapon. And this nonsense that has been proffered by Lindsey Graham, Jack Keane, and Witkoff even, that they were 2 weeks away from having bomb-making material, was a lie. It was just categorically, it was a lie. That was exposed during the testimony, I think, last week in the Senate and the House by Director Gabbard, who was pressed at one particular point by Senator Ossoff and said, were there military nuclear facilities obliterated in 2025? Yes. Had they made any effort, according to the intelligence assessment, to resuscitate that and to rebuild it? No. Ergo, it is a physical impossibility for there to have been an imminent threat, which the White House claimed, from nuclear stuff. And for some reason, she wouldn't just say it out loud, although she did put it in a written testimony. But that fact was exposed in there. So even from the administration, they're talking about how, no, there was no justification for us to have gone in there. So then the only one left is Israel, because they have been begging us to go and fight Iran for a long time. As you may remember, that actually President Biden came under a lot of withering pressure from Israel, and he gave in a whole bunch of ways, especially on the poor Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, turned a blind eye in the West Bank and even some of the other things that Israel was doing in Syria and in Lebanon. But he wouldn't go that far. And so they tried to get him to go into Iran. He wouldn't do it. But finally, here comes Trump, and they were able to push him over that line. I mean, it's pretty clear. And to me, it's cut and dry. There's really not any question about it at all.